We're reading from the Chaitanya Charitamrita, from the Adi Lila, chapter 15, text 17 through 22, and 22 is on the board, and there are no purports for the previous text. So I will read them. So this is text 17. After his father and mother sprinkled water on his mouth with great haste, the Lord revived and said something wonderful they had never heard before. So what happened? The Lord is unconscious? Anyone remember? What happened? Visharup took sannyas and they fainted? Is that what? Betel nut and? Lord Chaitanya fainted. Because it was prasadam and he had? Oh, to teach that you shouldn't take betel nuts. Is that it? So he fainted? Oh, okay. That makes more sense. Well, 1970, some people gave us betel nuts. So if you want to know what happens when you take betel nuts, you can ask me later. But we were definitely in a very good mood after eating the betel nuts. That's for sure. And we realized by eating the betel nuts that we're not supposed to eat betel nuts, even though they're offered to Krishna. But we didn't know that until we ate them and found out that we shouldn't eat them because it changes the way you feel. If you know what I mean. Yeah, okay. Okay. Text, what did I do? Text 18. The Lord said, Vishwarup took me away from here and he requested me to accept the sannyas order. I replied to Vishwarup, I have my helpless father and mother, and also I am but a child. What do I know about the sannyas order of life? So he's pacifying his parents, right? They're afraid that's what's happened, that he's going to take sannyas. Or they'd asked him not to? Is that what's happening? Something like that. Please don't do what your brother did. Yeah. Don't do what your brother did. You'll kill us if you do, more or less, right? Okay. Later I shall become a householder and thus serve my parents. For this action will very much satisfy Lord Narayana and his wife, the goddess of fortune. Text 21. Then Vishwarup returned home and requested. Excuse me. Then Vishwarup returned me home and requested, offer thousands and thousands of obeisances unto my mother Sachi Devi. So that brings us to today's verse, which we're... In this way, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu performed various pastimes. But why he did so, I cannot understand. The Supreme Personality of Godhead and his devotees who come to this world are executing a mission. And therefore, sometimes they act in a way that is very difficult to understand. It is said, therefore, Vaishnavera Kriya Mudha Vigye Nabhujhai. Even if one is a very learned and intelligent scholar, he cannot understand the activities of a Vaishnava. A Vaishnava accepts anything favorable for executing his mission. But foolish persons, not knowing the purpose of such exalted Vaishnavas, indulge in criticizing them. That is forbidden. Since no one can understand what a Vaishnava does for the purpose of executing his mission, to criticize such a Vaishnava is the offense called sadhu ninda. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Ukam karuti vachalam pangulangai te girim yak kripa tamaham vande sri guru dinatharinam panchakao paturubhyascha kripa sindubhyeva cha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namah. As many of you know, Srila Prabhupada was criticized for coming to the West and preaching. Well, yes, in a sense, for coming in the first place, because having the audacity to think he could make Westerners Vaishnavas. So that was one of the main criticisms. And there were, when he was successful and he actually did that, some people would say, well, they're not actually Vaishnavas. Or they would accept that they're Vaishnavas, but his methodology of allowing women to live in temples and so forth and was not proper. And Prabhupada mentions in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that he's being criticized for this. And he made the point that for all the criticism that I'm given, what are the people doing who have criticized and look at what I'm doing? And he's making the same point here. Because he says, well, he's making the point, these people don't understand the mission. And the mission is to spread Krishna consciousness somehow or other. And they want to stick to their rules and regulations, so they're criticizing. They don't understand the principle is higher. That's the point. And then Prabhupada says, what does he say? A Vaishnava accepts any favor, anything favorable for executing his mission. So that's the point. One time, a very good principle. One time there was a man, it was probably 1972, and he was a professor, about 35. So I have to put this in context. A 35-year-old professor joined, which today would be like kind of normal or, you know, nice, but nothing special. But in those days, everyone who was joining was a 22-year-old hippie, either just graduated from university or dropped out or ready to drop out or somewhere in between. So for a 35-year-old professor to join, that was kind of a big thing for us. And that was kind of old for a 22-year-old. I was 22 in 1972, so 35 was kind of old for me. So this was something new. And he had become a devotee, and his family did not. And he was confused about what to do. So he was initiated by Prabhupada. I think his name was Ramanuja. And I think he was actually Muslim. So it was kind of special. Professor, Muslim, older, family man. And his wife was cooking meat and feeding meat to the children. So he asked, he wrote Prabhupada, said, what should I do? And Prabhupada gave an interesting instruction, which we could apply to practically every decision we have to make. Prabhupada said, he didn't tell them, leave your family. He didn't say anything. He just said, do what's favorable for bhakti. And avoid what's unfavorable. In other words, he was giving it back to him, like, you decide. This is the principle. So this is the principle that Prabhupada's making here. We have to do what's favorable for spreading Krishna consciousness. That's the highest principle. That's what Prabhupada's meditating on. So then Prabhupada makes the point. He's making the point. He's basing this off the statement of Krishnadas Kaviraj that I don't understand Mahaprabhu's activities. They're confidential, they're secret. And he's making this logical conclusion that if you don't understand it, there's a good chance you're going to criticize it because you don't understand it. Yes? And that's Prabhupada's point. You don't understand my mission, therefore you're criticizing it, and you're thinking that I'm not discriminating, I'm not following properly. So it brings up an interesting concept. There's many things that it brings up. But one of the things that grabbed me, which I think is important for us to realize, is that we live in a subjective world. That means you and I see the world slightly differently. You like your potatoes baked, I like mine fried. If I give you baked potatoes, you get nauseous. If you give me baked potatoes, my mouth waters. So my reality is baked potatoes are mouth-watering, and your reality is baked potatoes make you nauseous. Now, what's the truth? Do baked potatoes, are baked potatoes mouth-watering, or are they nauseating? Well, for me, they're mouth-watering. That's my reality. So my conclusion is baked potatoes are mouth-watering, and that's the absolute truth for me. Now you can apply that principle. Everything. We enter a situation, we view it, we have an intellectual and emotional response to it, and that becomes our truth. That's what's happening. There's a funny saying, nothing means anything until you show up. Because when you show up, you evaluate it. And once you've evaluated, that's what it means to you. Either intellectual evaluation or how you feel. So, there's an interesting saying to illustrate this reality. Don't believe everything you feel. Should I say that again? Well, let me explain first, then I'll say it again. We have emotional responses to events. You did something, or you said something, and I have a certain feeling about it. I feel that was incorrect, or I feel that was very good. I feel you shouldn't have done it, or I'm happy you've done it. And I can intellectualize that also. Philosophically, I could establish why Prabhupada would be pleased or wouldn't. So I'm having a response, intellectually and emotionally. And sometimes it's only emotional, sometimes it's only intellectual. But something's going on, and that's defining now my reality. This is bad. What he did is good, what he did is bad, based on how I feel. So now my feelings become the truth of the situation. Does that make sense? Is that true? Sometimes. And the more you're Krishna conscious, the more true it is, because your feelings will be more in line with Shastra. What the truth is, not always what you feel or see is true, but what's true is what the Shastra, if you see through Shastra, that's true. But do we always see through Shastra? No. So, what's being said here is, Mahaprabhu's activities are difficult to understand. Prabhupada quotes the verse that a Vaishnava's activities are difficult to understand, and unless you're a pure devotee, you won't understand. And we, as conditioned souls, often respond emotionally and intellectually to situations with a very conditioned understanding, which, if we're not careful, for us becomes, this is the truth, this is how it is, I won't budge. And it may not actually be supported by Shastra. Does that make sense? Yeah. So, it's difficult to detach ourselves from our emotional connection with the situation, because what we feel tends to be how we evaluate everything. Right? So, for me, baked potatoes is reality. And fried potatoes are horrible because they're not good for you. So that's my reality. So when I see fried potatoes, what do you call them? You call them chips, right? In America, we call them French fries. What do they call them in France? So I see them, my emotional response is, it's not healthy. We have different realities. And if we give too much into our emotional reality, we can be misled. Now, Prabhupada then goes in the purport to sadhu ninda, fault finding. And we can see that the people that criticized Prabhupada were having an emotional response. What's the emotional response? Prabhupada is spoiling Vaishnava Dharma by either giving it to people who are unqualified malechas and giving them brahminical initiation, or by some of the other things that he's doing, such as allowing women to live in the temple. He was criticized because he's a sannyasi. He got disciples married. So we can imagine what's going on. They're thinking our dharma, our Vaishnava dharma, is being contaminated. It's being misrepresented. So there's an emotional response to that. It's not just intellectual, right? So they're seeing Prabhupada's activities also through their emotional response. And what's the result of that emotional response? Criticism. In my estimation, in this purport, when Prabhupada's saying this last line, since no one can understand what a Vaishnava does for the purpose of executing his mission, to criticize such a Vaishnava is the offense called sadhu ninda. I believe Prabhupada's talking about himself, at least partially, because that's what happened to him. And he did talk to us about it, not to criticize his godbrothers, but to edify, to clarify for us that he's doing the right thing, and instead of supporting and appreciating, they're criticizing, which is an effect of not understanding clearly the mission of Bhakti Siddhanta. And that sometimes Prabhupada refers to that. They didn't understand. So I think he's just emphasizing those points and not coming out and saying, this is I'm being criticized, but I think we can understand his mission wasn't executed. They didn't understand how he was executing his mission, and therefore they were criticizing. So, does that make sense so far? Yeah. So now, when you criticize, is there some emotion involved in criticism? Or is it all intellectual? It's obviously emotional, right? You're upset about something. Why do they do this? ISKCON is 50 years old and they still do this. That's not an intellectual, necessarily, entirely. There's a lot of emotion, right? Now, I have to be completely honest. I travel a lot, and periodically, I have an emotional response to ISKCON where I see something that I don't like, and I think it's so difficult to support a temple or a zone or the movement in general if they allow this to go on. It's not an intellectual response. It's emotional. It's just, I can feel it. It feels bad. And as a result, I can become critical if I'm not careful, because if it's just intellectual, it's easier to control, isn't it? If it's emotional, it's harder to control. So generally, criticism is an emotional response to a situation either we don't like, or to people we don't like, or to people who we actually do like, but we don't like them because they're doing better than we're doing. So therefore, I like you, but I don't, because you make me feel bad because you're better than me. You understand? Sometimes we don't like people because they're good. Isn't that crazy? And then we become envious. So on an emotional level, there's things going on. And now our reality is that you're bad. Because you're doing good, my reality is you're bad. So I think that point there of Prabhupada saying is you can't understand the reality of a Vaishnava if you're going to look at him this way. And the other interesting thing that struck me from this verse, which is as a understanding or realization that is always getting edified over the years, but we, most of us, if not all of us, understand how bad it is to criticize a Vaishnava. But that's not enough to stop us from doing it. Yes or no? Like, if I tell you, you know, if I dedicate this whole class to not criticizing a Vaishnava, it's not going to be the first time you've heard everything I say. Maybe I'll say it, you know, in a different way. But basically, you're going to hear what you've heard before. And that's not sufficient. That has not sufficient for many of us to stop criticizing. That's an interesting point. Why does that happen? Why? What's going on? I've heard. And I've heard and I do it. Isn't that interesting? I can try to describe my realization. And I believe this applies to all aspects of Krishna consciousness in which we understand, but we don't do. And I think we all understand that we understand and we don't always do what we understand we should do. And it generally comes out in expressions such as, I know I should, but. Have you ever said that? And what comes after the but? Well, if it's... Oh, it could be a criticism, yeah. I know I should, but the temple president is like this. Therefore I can't, as you say. Some form of rationale as to why I can't do it comes after the but. So that statement, I know I should, but, is a personification of what I've just said. I know I should means I have it in my head. I understand it. This is what should be done. And the but is a rationale why I'm not doing it. Now, what's interesting about that, if you know you should do something, why would you want a rationale not to do it? Does that make any sense? Raise your hand if that makes sense. Well, it makes sense. What I said makes sense, but I'm saying the action doesn't make sense. In other words, you say, I know I shouldn't criticize, but I'm so fallen, or things are wrong and I can't avoid them, or it bothers me and I can't control. The but is the rationale as to why you do it. So my point is, why would you want a rationale that rationalizes doing something that you've understood intellectually you don't want to do? Does that make any sense? It doesn't. So every one of us, when we become devotees, are challenged, I think, are challenged to become the personification of what Prabhupada taught. So I have a little joke. We were talking about this at Soho. It's called the 19th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. So then you're all wondering, what's the 19th chapter? Well, hopefully you know there's only 18. If you don't, I feel sorry for you. You should know that. What's the 19th chapter? Well, in this analogy, you have 18 chapters of Bhagavad Gita, and the 19th chapter is your life. And the 19th chapter should reflect the 18th chapters. So I can ask you the question. If you wrote your 19th chapter, would it look like the first 18, or would it look like something different? And if it looked different, how different would it look, and why, and where, and in what ways? So I think most of us realize that the 19th chapter may not look exactly always like the other 18 chapters. You agree? I mean, you can do some homework tonight and write your 19th chapter. So what could be better service to Prabhupada than to personify his teachings? I don't think there could be a better service. To live what he taught is the greatest glorification of Srila Prabhupada. You agree? There couldn't be any more glorification. So to know what he taught is important, but more important is to live it. And when we went to India in 1975, we were Sankirtan devotees, engaged 6 days a week in doing Sankirtan. And we had never had a month off with nothing to do. And so we went to Mayapur and we had no seva. So we understood we would do kirtan, we would hear and chant. We still had a lot of time. So a devotee said, Srila Prabhupada, what should we do? And Prabhupada said, just act, behave properly, act perfectly. That will be your preaching in India. Because people will see you and they'll see you're an American, you're acting like a perfect Vaishnava, and they will say, who is your spiritual master? You must have a wonderful spiritual master because you're a wonderful disciple. And your perfect behavior will glorify me. Isn't that amazing? Vice versa, right? It's also true. We'll be criticized if we don't represent Prabhupada properly. And it is also said, well, Prabhupada, when he went to Gita Nagari was a farm bought by the New York Temple. So that in the early days, temples would buy farms. Farms were connected with temples. It was one. So that was the farm for the New York City Temple. I think when they were in Manhattan. And Prabhupada called it Gita Nagari. Does anybody know why Prabhupada called it? Well, the name kind of gives it away, but does anybody know why he chose that name? Because he said, we are teaching, but we need a community that demonstrates what we're teaching. So Gita Nagari, the village where the Gita is lived. And it is said that the best way you can glorify a person is to create a community of people who live together following his teachings. So that was the idea of Gita Nagari, right? That it would be a community where we could show this is how you live, the teachings that we're teaching you in the city, that we're giving you, but this is a manifestation of it. So Prabhupada, these are two instances in which Prabhupada was very focused on example. Now you may know another instance where Prabhupada focused on example. it was when devotees were complaining about other devotees. Often when devotees complained, Prabhupada's reply was, be the example that you want them to be, and your example will influence them. And interestingly, this is such an important point in Vaishnava practice that Srila Bhakti Siddhanta would not allow his disciples to criticize. And so when they came to criticize, they'd say, Guru Maharaj, we have a problem with such and such. He'd say, oh yes, okay, let's discuss. And then they would come, and then he would say, can you say something good about this devotee? And then he would think of something, and he would give his appreciation. And then the disciple would say, now, can I tell you the problem? And he would say, no, meeting's over. Is that interesting? The devotee thought he was coming to a meeting to discuss the problem, and he wouldn't let him discuss it. He made him glorify the devotee, and now the meeting's over. He was setting an amazing example of not criticizing. Now, he said something amazing. I don't know if you've heard this. He said, a Vaishnava cannot become a guru. Why? Have you heard that before? Why a Vaishnava, you know, should all the ISKCON gurus now resign after hearing this statement? He said, a Vaishnava cannot become a guru. Why? He said, because a Vaishnava does not criticize. And the duty of a guru is to criticize his disciples, chastise, correct. Therefore, a Vaishnava does not criticize, therefore a Vaishnava cannot become a guru. Is that amazing? Would you like to hear his conclusion? He did have a conclusion. He said, we cannot become guru because we must criticize, and Vaishnavas does not criticize. He said, but we've been ordered by our guru to become guru. Therefore, this criticism or this correction is done in the mood that I'm servant of my disciple. I'm always in that. That's my bhav. I'm always in that bhav. That I'm servant. That these are the people Krishna has sent me to serve. I'm never in the superior position. And therefore, when I criticize, I correct. It's totally in the mood of service. So there's no criticism. He said, only in that way can Vaishnava be a guru. Now, 1972, in Los Angeles, in a class I was attending that Prabhupada gave, he was talking about this, and he said, if you are envious, if you are jealous, you are in the material world. And if you are not envious and you're not jealous, you're in the spiritual world. This was kind of a direct black and white statement, pretty heavy, and it's very clear. Now, add to that, a Vaishnava doesn't criticize. Now we have a pretty high standard of what it means to be a Vaishnava. Sisi Radha Gokula Ananda Ki Jai. Vaishnava is not envious, correct? It's right in Bhagavatam, Nirmatsuranam Sutam. And he doesn't criticize. That's a Vaishnava. Now, there's another heavy thing. I think it's heavy. Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, he said, when you achieve the stage of bhava, that bhava means emotion, and that means your emotion is entirely now for Krishna. It's not for anything material. In the stage of bhava, one of the symptoms of bhava is detachment. Why is that? Why is it considered on that stage the symptom is detachment? Because all your bhava, all your emotion is for Krishna, and there's no emotion for anything material. Does that make sense? All your emotion is for Krishna and Krishna's devotees and Krishna's service. And there's no emotion, therefore, for anything material. And that's two stages above ruchi. So even on the stage of ruchi, there's so much taste, it detaches you. Does that make sense? You have so much taste, you can't get interested in something not Krishna conscious. But on the stage of bhava, it's not just taste, it's emotion. So it's magnified. So he said, love of Krishna is emotion, bhav directed towards Krishna. And then he said something interesting. And he said that same emotion, when directed, that same emotion of love that you have to Krishna, when you take that emotion, that feeling, and you direct it towards everyone else, it's called daya, compassion. It's the same emotion in a different direction. Isn't that interesting? You understand? Should I say that again? Right. The same feeling that you have for Krishna, which is called bhav, or love, or preliminary love, when that same feeling is directed to everyone else, it's called compassion. It's the same emotion with a different outlet. Well, I think we can understand the opposite. What's the opposite? I cannot criticize you. I cannot be envious of you unless I'm envious of Krishna. I cannot love you unless I love Krishna. Does that make sense? That's what he's saying. And we've heard that early on in our devotional life, haven't we heard? All envy stems from envy of Krishna, and I cannot be envious of you unless there's some envy in my heart towards Krishna. So I cannot criticize you unless there's some envy in my heart. And all these statements that Prabhupada's saying, if you're envious, you're in the material world, you're not a Vaishnava if you criticize, I think they're very important for us. But again, it begs the question, okay, I understand it, it's in my head, why do I do it? Why do I continue to do it? And I can share my own realization. I have thought about it. I've tried not to be critical, and sometimes I still am. And there's a couple of realizations I came to. Generally, we look at this problem as a spiritual problem. I'm envious of Krishna. And it's true. But there are also other aspects of it that affect us on a more practical level. I once had a meeting with five devotees. And I said, I want to start a company where we teach Krishna consciousness in a more lifestyle-oriented way, where we help people change their lifestyle, we help people solve their problems, we show them how to become happy in a sattvic way. Would you like to help? And you know what their answer was? I can't help you. I said, why? I said, because I'm not happy. Every person said that. And they were all older devotees. I said, how can I do this? It will be a paradox, because I'm not happy in my Krishna consciousness. Interesting, isn't it? So when we're not happy in our Krishna consciousness, at that point we become very liable to be critical of others. When we are frustrated with ourselves, we become very liable to be critical of others. You agree? Have you ever had that experience, like subconsciously, that a person who's very critical must be very unhappy? You see it, you feel it, you understand, somehow or other it's communicated, that why is he or she dwelling on this? Do they not have anything else to do? How is it that they're getting pleasure from this? By condemning someone? Haribol. Once there was a devotee, and he wrote Prabhupada a letter, and he said, Prabhupada, I'm thinking I should do this, but maybe that, or maybe this, or maybe that, which we call the mental platform, right? Actually, the mental platform, what it actually means according to Bhagavatam is just sense gratification. Mental, you know, I'm on the mental platform means I want to enjoy. I like this, I don't like that. So we use that word when a devotee's not stable. We say he's mental. Like tottering, going back and forth. So it's okay, but its original application was accepting and rejecting on the basis of what will give me sense pleasure. So Prabhupada wrote him back, and he said, the attitude of a devotee, he wasn't happy because the devotee was unsettled. Maybe I should do this, maybe I should do that, maybe I should go here, maybe I should go there. So Prabhupada was kind of analyzing it as, you're just thinking about what you want to do, what you like, what you don't like. And then he wrote him a very interesting letter, and he said, a devotee is satisfied with a little prasadam, a little service, and I don't know if he said 6 feet to sleep, but basically that's the impression I got. You know, a little space where you can lay down at night, some prasadam to keep you going, and some service, and a devotee's satisfied. So, of course, we want service that inspires us. And if the service inspires us, it's according to our nature, we'll be satisfied. So my realization is that generally, devotees who are more enriched, satisfied in their service and their sadhana, who are going deeper into their Krishna consciousness, you will tend, maybe you have this experience, you will tend to find they more lavishly give out appreciation. It's just, they're happy, they're satisfied, they're enriched in their own bhakti, and because of that, they tend to appreciate devotees more. Have you seen that? Any of you noticed that? You know devotees that they always say good things about everyone? You know devotees? You don't know any like that? Yes. Sometimes very, very advanced devotees are like that. They're praising others who are not even near them and just appreciating them. You're doing such amazing service. You know, someday I hope I could do such service. To me, that's an indication that they're very deeply swimming in the ocean of Krishna consciousness and they're very deeply satisfied with their service in sadhana. Now, I'm not saying to try to rectify a problem is wrong, that sometimes we do that because it's our duty. But I just want to tell you that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta said something amazing. He said, even if you see a fault, you don't have the right to criticize. Because generally the concept of fault finding is, well, it's not really a fault, but I'm making it up, right? So he takes it to the next level. Okay, it is a fault. Everybody can see it's a fault. But his point was, when you get fixated on that fault, that's a problem. Both because you did it and both as a consequence of doing it. You understand? The fact that you're fixated on this person's problem is an indication of your problem. And because you're doing it, it's going to create further problems. And so he said, in his own humility, he said, the reason I don't appreciate devotees is because I don't have one drop of humility. And so turn it around. He said, if I have humility, I will appreciate. His exact words are, I cannot appreciate the lotus feet of the Vaishnavas because I don't have a drop of humility. Of course, he's teaching us. But that's my point. When someone is advancing in Krishna consciousness and they're happy, they don't need to pull anybody down to make them feel good because they're satisfied in their Krishna consciousness. When you need to pull someone down to make you feel good, you need to reflect and think, there must be something missing in my spiritual life. If it makes me unhappy to see a devotee succeeding more than I am succeeding, there must be something wrong with my spiritual life. So-and-so Prabhu is distributing books. That's pleasing Prabhupada. I don't like it. Because he's getting more honor than I am. That means something's wrong with me. I don't like that a devotee is pleasing my spiritual master. And I think we've all been through it, haven't we? Your god brother or god sister does some outstanding service. And you would have liked to do it, but you didn't, or you can't. Or maybe never in this life will you do it, and you don't like them. And you become envious or critical. Well, the reason they did it is because they got help from so-and-so, and otherwise they couldn't have done. You know, some reason you try to rationalize to make yourself feel better. That's a sign we're not in line with what Prabhupada said, 6 feet, little prasadam, and some service and be satisfied. That's a sign of a Vaishnava, that he's satisfied. So I think that's very important. That's one of my realizations why we fault find. We're not satisfied in our own spiritual lives. Our chanting is not going deep enough. Our maybe relationships are not good. We're not taking the time to study Prabhupada's books. We're not discussing it well. Something, our service, is we haven't found our dharma. We're not connected to something that inspires us. Something's missing. And therefore, we're not satisfied. That's my personal experience. And generally, I find the devotees who are relishing Krishna consciousness are the most lavish with their praise of others. Even praising younger devotees, newer devotees. And they're very happy to do it. It makes them feel good. It's not like, I know I'm supposed to do it, so I'll do it. So that's something we can reflect on in our own heart. If there's some enmity for another devotee, some need to criticize, let's look in our own heart. Now, there's another reason that we may do this, and it's a very interesting reason, and I think we're all aware of it, but I just want to talk about it because I think it's good to talk about it and we can reflect on this. Sometimes, when we have an anartha or a problem, it bothers us when we see another person with the same problem because it reminds us that we have the same problem. And sometimes it's subconscious. We won't even admit we have the problem. We just don't like it when we see another person. I don't know if you have this experience. Have you ever seen a devotee chatting japa? Not chanting, but chatting japa? You know how to chat japa? You know what that means? Talking, yeah. You know, they're out in the hallway and they're chatting japa. And if you ever see a devotee chatting japa and it like upsets you, has it ever like, I shouldn't be doing that? This is, you know, you actually have an emotional response to it. It's probably because you do it also. If you don't do it, you may not like it. You may think it's not good. You won't have a very negative emotional response. Only if you do it. And it's reminding you that you do it all the time. You don't like to see other people do something wrong that you do. So rather than condemn them, it's nice to recognize it's probably I'm seeing what I do and that's why it's upsetting me. Because we all do many things wrong, and I'm sure not everything that everybody does wrong bothers you. But there are some things that will bother you. And it's likely it's something that you need to deal with yourself, and that's why it bothers you. Because you're not dealing with it. Does that make sense? Can you relate to that? No? Yes? Maybe? Yeah. So, these are things we can reflect on. And just to kind of coat it over a little bit, sometimes devotees will say, I'm lazy. And there's a rephrasing of I'm lazy. And I would rephrase it this way, I haven't found a service that inspires me. That's actually a more accurate description of being lazy. They're not actually lazy, but they haven't connected with a service that's within their nature that inspires them. Does that make sense? So we're talking about being satisfied. That comes from good association, good sadhana, going more deeply in the holy name. And I have to tell you a story. This is a classic story about the satisfaction that comes from connecting with your dharma. I was at the Vyas Puja of Tamalkrishna Maharaj, the late 90s, I believe. And that was during the time he was doing his doctorate work, when he was in college. And his, whatever you call the person when you're doing a PhD, what do you call them? Mentor or whatever, yeah. Guide or some guide? Guide. Okay, so that he invited his guide, his mentor, to the Vyas Puja. They had a close relationship, right? And tutor. Yeah, in America there's another name I can't think of. Anyway, you understand. So this was the person he was working with on his doctorate or his master's. He skipped his master's, right? Went straight to doctorate. Yeah. So they had this amazing relationship, and I noticed something about the professor, and I noticed something about a lot of devotees, which was quite interesting. The professor was very happy, and a lot of devotees were very unhappy. And I want to explain why, because it relates to this point of Dharma. And I had a big epiphany at that Vyas Puja. This professor was in his Dharma. And you could see by the comments he was making, by the relationship he had with Tamal Krishna Maharaj, you could see he was professor from head to toe. He loved to study, he loved to teach, he loved to do research, he loved to be a professor, speculate, theorize, contemplate, counter-arguments, theses, antithesis, never come to a conclusion, talk forever. He was a professor at heart, and it was so obvious from the interactions and exchanges, right? He was a Brahmin in the sense of the modern Brahmin in the West. It was obvious. And you could see how happy he was to be working with Tamal Krishna Maharaj, not only because Tamal Krishna Maharaj was an amazing person to work with and he was benefiting from that association, but just because he loves his job. In the audience, I happen to know there were many Brahminical devotees who were engaged in non-Brahminical work, who were selling something because they were all university dropouts and married and they had to make money, so they were selling something. Whatever that something was, just they had to sell something to make money. And because they were Brahmins, they were quite unhappy having a little kiosk in a mall or a store selling some toy or some painting or some necklace or something. When at heart, they were teachers and they were Brahmins. And I knew them. And as I said earlier, we got this group of devotees together who said, I can't teach happiness because I'm not happy. When you're out of your dharma, you're not happy. Even you come to the kirtan and dance in ecstasy, but if you go back into a dharma which is not your dharma, you're not happy. And therefore you're not inspired. So when you're happy in your sadhana and you're inspired in your devotional service, my understanding is that that is one of the best remedies for being critical. Because in your heart, you're satisfied. And so you don't have a need to bring other people down. You don't need to present yourself as better. You're satisfied with who you are, and you're satisfied with the holy name and your Krishna consciousness. So these are just ideas I wanted to throw out to reflect. And I think the Prabhupada, those God brothers that criticized Prabhupada, were in some level dissatisfied that they couldn't do it. Because that order to preach in the West, that was not just for Prabhupada. Every one of them were given that order, and he did it. Something must have been going on some level. Maybe they weren't conscious that they should have done it, and they failed. And the only way to deal sometimes with failure is to criticize the person who succeeded. Because if you can pull him down, you won't feel so bad, and you don't have to deal with it. Does that make sense? Yeah. So these are some of my observations. Now we were supposed to end 5 minutes ago. But I heard a rumor, if you're a visiting devotee and you don't always give class here, you could go longer. True or false? No, I don't want to say anything. I just want to take questions. Or Maharaj, if you have any comments. I don't like to just end class when people are dying to ask questions, but we have to be conscious of time because we're also starting another class at 9:30. So, you have a question, comment? Oh. Yeah, so the class fell on deaf ears because none of you were envious, yeah. I'll give you another thought. I've told you this last time, but there's a group of people called the Amish, and they forgave. Did I tell you this story? They forgave the family that killed their children, murdered them cold-blooded, just shot them. And it was analyzed by a very well-educated pastor of one of the most prestigious churches in America, Washington Cathedral. And he said, the reason they could do that is because they were forgiveness. That's who they were. They weren't thinking like, oh, Prabhu, I just can't forgive. You know, then I try to teach you and say, I know I should, but. So his point was, they were not, I know I should, but. They were hundreds of years past, I know I should, but. They live forgiveness. That's, so they personify their teachings. Their 19th chapter, or their whatever chapter of their Bible, their chapter is exactly the same as the rest of the Bible. That was his point. They've taken the teachings and their lifestyle, and they became one. So you would understand, if you live with them and they never told you what they believed, you would understand what they believed without a word by their lifestyle. Would people understand what we believe by our lifestyle? I don't want to say yes or no. I leave that for you to decide. If someone came here and we couldn't tell them what we believed, would they understand it by seeing the community? That's an interesting question. And that was his point. The philosophy and the lifestyle were not two different things. It's they were what they believed. He said, it's who they are. It's not who they what they believe, it's who they are. So I think that's our goal. Our 19th chapter, here's the 18th chapter, here's our life, the 19th chapter, and the 18th, they merge. So that's the challenge of representing Prabhupada. That's kind of my summation of the whole thing. Okay. Thank you very much.